Welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me. It's time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Glad to have you with me one more time. It's been a little bit of a space between this episode and the last episode that I did. I've been really busy with this Bridge radio show that I do on a daily basis. I actually tape the show for full disclosure purposes, Monday usually through Thursday, and then I take a couple days off. And so I'm playing catch up with a lot of different things. And one of the things that I find interesting is as long as I've been doing radio, 23 years now, even now, I find myself needing to take a break from talking about stuff when I've done it for so long. And I've always maintained that I don't want to just jump on and do this podcast because I can, meaning that I could turn the microphone at any time and just blather away and bloviate away and speculate and verbally defecate. And I don't want to do that. I want to, when something catches me or something is on me to share with you, then I fire this thing up and never before that. So in the beginning, when I started this back in 2018 already, I was on, you know, 4, 5, 6 times a month, and I was just cranking it out. And it has changed a little bit over time, mostly, as I say, because of the schedule I keep with broadcasting, which the show first heard in New York and Washington, D.C., and then it becomes a podcast for the rest of the world. And it's a lot of production and things and moving parts. So all good, but just keeps me really busy. So I'm glad to be back where I can say shit if I want, without worrying about the FCC. How about that shit? Pretty good shit, huh? I think so. Anyway, a little bit of a bittersweet episode today. I realized by checking the landfill of Facebook that my friend Hillary Ramo would have been 48 years young today. Hillary passed away last November, I believe it was the 12th, at the age of 47. It was very sudden. I did not hear about it for 3 or 4 days until I just happened across a posting about it on Facebook, and it was really shocking to me. And in 2020, I lost more friends than I've ever lost in 1 year in my entire life. And I got to the point where I have some of these guys that I played football with back in high school, and we have a memorial plaque for them. And I got tired of getting nameplates for this thing, so I actually took it off the wall. I couldn't look at it for a while. And it was getting to that point. And when I found out about Hillary, it was really a gut punch. I have admired her work in radio and for years. She might have been one of the most fearless people I know when it comes to putting her voice into the world and challenging the status quo. And you talk about going up the down staircase. She did that all the time. We first met way back in 2008. She interviewed me for her radio show. And at the time, she was, you know, really nervous about it and everything. I was supposedly this big deal over at Oprah Radio. And I don't know how we connected originally. I think I'm actually going to play a little clip from a show we did last year, and she alludes to the fact that we had a mutual agent, Jenny Weissman, who did our literary work, so that's how we first met. And we became fast friends after that, and again, just admired. She was an incredible artist, and just, this is a person who used up her 47 years, and I think that's the sweet part of this. It's bitter that she's gone. Her family and her boys miss her tremendously, I'm sure. There are days that I think that really, she's really not going to call up and say, hey, what's going on? I've worked on her book projects, and editing out those out and helping her to fill in the blanks and actually helping her publish her last book, which was the transcripts of so many of the shows that she did. So worked very closely with her on all the different things. And there was something about her voice when the phone would ring and I'd see her name on there and she'd say, hey, JSA. It was just the way she said that. It was like, this is a person full of life, and 47 is terribly, terribly young to leave. So that being said, you know, I've always maintained to the best of my ability. Sometimes I do better at it than other days, but I've had to come to grips with the fact that for me, I think we come in on time and go out on time. And the little bit of time we have in between is so very, very important. It's best not to major in minor things if you can possibly avoid it. And Hillary Ramo never majored in minor things. She took on the big dog. She went after the big game and was fearless, as I mentioned. She was a force of nature. So I happened to come across the fact that today she'd be 48. I've been thinking about her on and off all day, and boy, it's got to be 4 years ago. She sent me this box, and in the box is this big crystal, and it's really an interesting piece, and I'm not real big on all of that stuff. I mean, I have appreciation for people that do, but this was important for her to send, and apparently it was something that her grandfather had given her, so I took great pride and respect in having it, and she was explaining that it's, you know, that this is the kind of thing that, you know, she draws energy from, that she would get clarity from by focusing and meditating and things like that. So I have that crystal. And this morning and this afternoon, when I realized it was her birthday, I thought about her sending that and what a great thing that was and what a great gift she was to the world. So it's a throwback Thursday in the fact that this show you're going to hear, or just a little clip of it actually, is from last year. In 2020, we started this show called The Bridge in September, and she was on in probably she was the seventh show, and just really, you know, had so much to say about the world and about life, and she was always so interesting and had so many great insights. So I thought what I would do is air that, and I had to do a lot of work on the audio. This is when we first started The Bridge. Last year, the audio problems were terrible, and I had one hell of a time trying to get this shit straight, and it still doesn't sound like it should. Well, we got it figured out now. It sounds great now, but back then it was terrible. As a matter of fact, the first show we ever did with Bill Curtis was like, I don't even know why we aired that. But anyway, that being said, I spent a little time cleaning up this clip with Hillary, and again, there I'll leave the revelations that you may or may not have to her. That being said, there is one revelation that was just paramount for me personally, and I know a lot of people listening to this particular episode of The Bridge last year felt the same way, is when Hillary starts talking about the beginner's mind and how much our egos get clogged up over a lifetime of preconceived notions of who people are, who we are, how the world is. And if we could each just take a moment during the day and push all that stuff apart and see the world and see ourselves and our place in the world a little bit different with that beginner's mind, to not make, you know, preconceived judgments on every single thing that comes down the river, which is what we've been taught to do. Our brains going 1,000 miles an hour, that our lives would be so much better, even just for 5 minutes out of the day. And the other part of this, what you're going to hear, is my co-host, Hu Young, who is one of the top broadcasters in China on China Radio International. And this bridge show concept was brought to me by a friend of mine named Dan Mason, who just happened to be the president of CBS Radio for 20 years. And he brought me to The Bridge. He actually got me started in podcasting as well back in 2014 and 15. And he responded after the show with Hillary saying, what a great concept of this beginner's mind. And I go into those shows every time we tape with Hu Young, and I have a couple other co-hosts as well, thinking that the mandate that we created is to bring the world together one conversation at a time. There's a lot that pushes us apart. So if we could just do our diligence an hour a day with that beginner's mind to be able to see things a little bit differently than we did before, then we do in fact bring the world together just a little bit closer. Now, as I've said many times, and it's one of the main open themes of our show, is that lifelines are more important than headlines, but headlines grab our attention and lifelines tend to wither off on the side until we get that call or we find out that if someone who's important to us passed away, and then we're all worried about what's, you know, what happened and how did they die and what's the cause of their death. I could care less about the cause of death. It's all about the cause in life. I just wanted to hear her voice one more time. That is the great thing about all of our technology, is it not? I don't have any recordings of my folks. They don't exist. I don't have any videos. There's pictures, but it gets harder and harder over time for me to remember their voice, what it sounded like. I strain a little bit more than I used to. I have their picture right here on my desk, but my mom's laugh and my dad, how he sounded, they're getting more and more faint in my head. The one great thing about this technology is this stuff, for the most part, can live on forever. And to hear Hillary's voice again, not long before she passed away, was just a real, real gift to me. So without further delay, remembering my friend Hillary Ramo on what have been her 48th birthday. This is the bridge from last September 2020.
Okay.
Three, two, and one. I'm really excited, as I am with all the guests that we have on the bridge and working with Hu Young on having these conversations that literally bring the world closer together. And somebody who does that in such great form is Hillary Ramo. She's an award-winning photographer. She's an artist. She's a writer. She's been a painter and actually a photographer most of her life. And she, this is what I love about her. She never sees the world the same way twice. Now, that's a gift. Her work has been shown in Albany Center Gallery, Spring Street Gallery in Saratoga Springs, the Yaddo Exhibit, and is regularly featured in the traveling exhibits of the Schenectady Photographic Society. And her work has received honorable mention awards all over the place. She's also a multimedia artist. I want to let her explain what that really means. And she joins us from upstate New York. Hillary, welcome to the bridge.
Well, hello, John. Hello. Hello, everybody. It's so nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We're pleased to have you. Now you're in upstate New York, so you're probably, I don't know, from Chicago. I don't know, about 700, 800, 1,000 miles from me, something like that.
Walking distance, right, John?
That's right. Yeah, that's a whole other show, though. And so I'm drawing the connected dots. I have a little map here. Not really, but I'm pretending I do. And then we're going to go from Schenectady, or the upper, I should say, upstate New York, where you're at, to Chicago, and then all the way across 6,585 miles to Beijing with Hu Young, who is, you know, we're both admitting we're not connoisseurs of art. We're hoping you can enlighten us. But one of the things we both appreciate is the medium, and that's why we asked you to join us.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great time to talk about art. There's so many things going on in the world. You know, it's a positive topic, and it brings a lot of hope and excitement and joy, as far as I'm concerned.
When you study a subject, you must have heard me while you were on hold waiting to join us on the show about the idea that something comes along and grabs your attention, and then somehow that becomes a piece of work for you or an art piece. And I was talking about these things that have been around for hundreds of years, some little tiny sculptures, and some were big frame pictures. And I kept thinking, where does this all start? So from your artist eye and brain and thought and mind and heart, what's that process like for you?
Well, I think it starts with being amused. You know, artists have to find some sense of muse, and they have to feel it before they actually start to dream it and bring it into being. At least that's how it is for me. I know everybody has their own process, and I think that's what makes it so fantastic. And understanding an artist's process helps you to get into their head, to see where they're coming from, and to help deepen the field, as I call it. But for me, I have to find a muse. And if I find a muse, I know I can tell by a variety of different signs that this is going to be it. And I'll take that and run with it and see what happens. And sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not so great. But it's really about discovering a connection between yourself and the reality around you, and how you're going to interact in that space between you and that perceived thing. So, for example, there's a lot of things going on in the world right now. I know here in the West, we have a tremendous amount of uprising and upheaval and chaos, as some would say. But the artist is always able to go into that and find a way to navigate through that, to be able to transform the energies at work. So I hope we get to talk about that tonight. And Hu Young, I'd love to hear about the Eastern way of how art is done over there, because quite frankly, we here in the West don't hear an awful lot about what's going on in China. And I think that that bridge is so important, so that we can understand each other's cultures and be inspired and muse on them and see what comes out of it.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that art can be a connection in that way, I think. And when you say that you don't get to hear a lot about what goes on here in China about art, I guess also, you know, there is the language difference. And I guess for Chinese artists, it's only, I think, in recent years, the last couple of decades, did they get to sort of thrive again in the modern time. And but I guess, you know, just creating art, and it comes from the heart, and also, you know, drawing inspirations from the world around them. That is something that is the same possibly for artists around the world. And I mean, what are some of the most profound, like, muses that you have spotted and that have sort of inspired you to create your art?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, right before we went down into lockdown earlier this spring, I had quite a schedule planned for 2020, and I was really thinking I would be doing certain things. And in the end of February, I had gone to attend a lecture at the Zen Buddhist Monastery in Catskill. And it was a precursor to a trip that I had planned to go to India. I would be studying with a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer. We were going on a location study, so I wanted to have some background on India. And so going to the Buddhist monastery to live there for a weekend and to practice the way and to listen to some lectures that were coming was quite a decision, but it was so close to where I live that I just felt like I had to do it. So I went and I came back, and then of course the whole world locked down and all of my trips and exhibits for the spring and the summer got canceled. And ironically enough, the Zen monastery had opened up their teaching spaces remotely, so it was something new for them, where we would have people and students come every Friday to study Zen art with a sensei. And our sensei would lead us through a particular guided art lesson each week that had to do with the Zen precepts and had to do with the studying. So I sort of found myself saying, okay, well, I have nothing else to do. This sounds like fun. So I signed up, and then I found myself at the very first online introduction to Zen training, and I completed that as one of their first remote classes where they've trained people. So ironically enough, this entire pandemic lockdown has led me to Buddhism and understanding it in deeper and more meaningful ways. So to complement that, I signed up for an online course at Harvard this summer that studied the ancient Chinese philosophy, particularly Confucius and some of the other philosophers that have a long history of building the philosophy of ancient China. And so it was a beautiful historical context for what I was learning in meditation and Zazen and doing the practices and signing up for these things so that I could fill my time with positive things to do. And it's been a very interesting and rather unexpected journey, in the sense that learning about Buddhism has brought me back to some very ancient and old teachings that come from the East that have been accepted here in the West, but they're taught a little bit differently. But they're taught according to how our culture is. And so my muse really has been, quite by accident and synchronistically, the East, and coming into a Zen state of mind, a Buddha mind, and being able to look at what's going on from a very different perspective. And so the artwork that we focused on for the past 6 months have been really related to the emotional landscape and exploring what's going on the outside world and how that relates to the inside world. And so it's been quite an extraordinary. So I've done nothing but study with the monastery since this whole thing has happened. And I have found myself approaching my art with much more focus, with a different kind of laser-like focus that I didn't, not that I didn't have before necessarily, but in a different way. So Buddhism has really shaped my art practice these last 6 months. So I can relate to this odd bridge that happens between East and West, especially after going through what I've gone through, studying with the sensei and the roshis and learning the meditation practice of Zazen and clearing the mind and being able to really let go of everything that grasps for your attention and being able to focus. So that's been my muse, in my own work lately.
That is fascinating. Because when you mentioned the Buddhism and also Confucius, you know, these are concepts and teachings that have such rich history and so much to study and learn about. And in China, like, as I was growing up as a little girl, like, we pick up bits and pieces, like, in just, you know, common conversation, like little sayings or some old maxims and those kind of things. But it's also for, I think, Chinese people, like, a lot of us sort of decided that we want to have some sort of peace, or just having that peace in mind, especially during the coronavirus. And it's inspired more people to sort of search a bit more into history to find those pieces kind of thing. And it's just so interesting that, you know, I'm hearing this from you, Hillary, that, you know, at different places in the world, but we sort of went on a similar kind of journey, at least trying to find that place that we feel safe spiritually during the lockdowns, during such turbulent times when we don't seem to always understand what's going on in the world. But what does Confucius mean to you? As in, you mentioned something like it might be taught a little bit differently over there as opposed to where it could be here at home in China for me. Do you mind just going a little bit more in depth in sort of exploring those intricacies?
Sure. In fact, one of the most interesting thing to me when I was studying about Confucius was his belief in rituals. And the way that he explained rituals wasn't so much about burning incense and saying prayers as it was being present in each moment and taking each interaction as a ritual. So let me explain. So this interesting concept would allow somebody to, let's say you have somebody walk into the room that you haven't seen in a while, and the last time that you did see them, you didn't have such great experience. So you have a lot of preconceived anxieties perhaps about what this person might bring into your space. So you ritualize the space by sort of shamanizing the space. I mean, what I have found in all the ancient religions really is a common thread of shamanic mysticism, which means basically that there's very similar things in all the different cultures around the world if you go back far enough. And you would ritualize this space or shamanize this space by perhaps putting beautiful flowers in the middle of the room, lighting a little bit of incense, having some beautiful food, maybe perhaps in setting the tone or doing tea and setting the tone for a calm space. And you realize that these anxieties that live within you are problems and they need to go. So you practice letting them go and meeting the person as a blank slate, because you don't know what a person's gone through from the last time you've seen them. Perhaps they've had some significant aha moments. Perhaps they've had life-changing things. Perhaps they've had a crisis or some sort of loss that has changed them. So what I love about Confucius is he really did teach his disciples how to interact with people in such a way that allowed for the expression of growth and healing. And so every opportunity that you cross paths with people becomes an opportunity to do ritual, which means, in a sense, in its simplest form, seeing the Buddha in somebody the way you see the Buddha in yourself, or you see God, or, you know, I don't get caught up on labels. That's something that I've studied a lot of religions and ancient cultures. And one of the things I've always found is that when you start to really define everything by exactly what you've been taught, you sort of lose the point. So ritual, Confucius taught ritual as a sense of sacred conversation, kind of what we're doing right now. So if we were to ritualize this space that you and John and I have created, it would be to be mindful about the things that we're saying, to be thankful for the platform that we're saying it on, and to be able to see the larger, bigger picture, because that's really what we're asked to do, especially in times of crisis. We really can't lose that spiritual dimension in times of crisis. We need to have that bigger, broader, higher, you know, perspective to be able to see what's going on sometimes. And that doesn't mean that you lose sight of the things that are important, but you're able to really take a look and see things that perhaps you might have been clouded if you weren't such a more broad perspective, because you're caught up in something perhaps emotional or mental. But ritual, you know, it was a beautiful way of describing how to be mindful in conversation space, or in whatever it is that you're doing. So let's say you go to the grocery store and you're checking out, and the lady who's checking you out looks very sad and she might be having a bad day. And you notice that and you become mindful of her feeling. And so you smile at her and you say something kind of positive to her. And that lifts up her energy. It makes her smile. It makes her feel so. Some of us would just dismiss that as being a nice person, and that's true. But on a deeper philosophical level, what you've done is actually a ritual. You've actually noticed, been mindful of what's happening, acknowledged it, and then you've done something to add into the energy to help shift and change it. So learning this as a Western woman from Eastern philosophy really was quite a beautiful way, because I've studied a lot here in the West, and, you know, sometimes it seems very, you know, the same thing over and over again. And I'm like, oh yeah, I've done this 1,000 times and I know what's going to happen. But the Eastern view brings in something that I feel the whole Western world is missing. It's a very different spiritual dimension that asks us to seek constantly to be good people. And so I've really enjoyed this historical depth of exploring what the background of Buddhism is, and also experiencing it, because they're not necessarily telling me the historical aspect of the monastery, but Harvard is, and I'm learning and putting it all together, and I'm saying, wow, this really makes sense. And if more people understood the spiritual dimensions of the East, the West would probably grow up a little bit faster.
Well,
wow,
you're very optimistic, and you know, over the times we've been doing this show, I have learned so much and remembered so much talking with Hu Young, because she was where I was 30, never mind how many years ago, but I've had a lot more miles on me, and the experiences have bent me in certain ways that are good, in some ways not so good, but they always bring me back around to the purpose of being alive. And that sounds a bit of a broad brush, but when you were talking, Hillary, you were mentioning about the, you know, the sacredness and the respect of space and of communication. And once again, just to bring it up, that none of us can see each other. I've done thousands of radio shows and I've never saw the person who was on the other end of the line. And after so long of a career, at one point I could almost tell what people were having for breakfast and the clothes they were wearing by the way they talked. Their influences, their inflections, their energy. So I'm listening to you speak, and I'm listening to the words that you're saying, and these are being basically, you know, thrown out into the universe through this amazing project called The Bridge, landing on people all over the world. And thinking of that and walking in purpose and speaking in purpose on that reminds me that we're all broadcasting all the time. That just because you and I and Hu Young happen to have microphones tonight and we're doing a radio show doesn't mean that every person listening or anybody out in the world is also broadcasting all the time. And we have to be mindful, or not, of what we're putting out, because there's this rebound effect that takes place. I call it, you know, karma is just the easy word for it. But I've realized over time that you can almost see the boomerang come back. What you put out comes back, and sometimes it's when you least expect it, in ways you could never predict. But I'm more and more mindful of how I'm acting or reacting in the world, as opposed to, you know, just stepping back for a second, taking a deep breath, and learning to respond. And just real quick, I don't know why this came to mind when you were talking, but one of the quotes, and I'm sure this is obviously, you know, been generalized, marginalized, and transitionalized many times over that Confucius said was, wherever so you go with all your heart. You live your life with your heart out into the world. And I have friends of mine that they don't like that. You know, they're not real fond of living with their heart outside their sleeve. They'd rather just keep it inside. And I've never once felt like I was diminished or disappointed every time I reached out for somebody else just in a response. So the other day I was at the store, I came out, and I had forgotten a shopping bag because we use these, permanent bags. And I went back into the car, opened the trunk, and I got my bag. And as I'm walking back out to go back in the store, this woman's coming towards me, younger lady, had a little kid, a lot of groceries in her cart, and the strawberries on top of the pile of her mountain of groceries got knocked off and fell off into the parking lot, and there were strawberries rolling all over the place. And people were walking by her like it didn't exist. It was so interesting. Like, everybody saw it. There had to be 10, 15 people. It was a big parking lot. And I didn't even think. I went over and started picking up these strawberries and talking to the little kid and helping her putting them on. And, I wasn't worried about the COVID or anything. I just immediately responded to what I saw happening. And when I put that back in there, she says, "That's the nicest thing anybody's done for me in probably 6 months. And aww. I thought, what a life. We all have this stuff. I mean, I'm not Superman or anything. But those kind of movements and moments, I think, fall in line with the energy of what you were talking about with the Tao and learning the way and being fully involved in the process, whether you understand it or not. So, and I do that stuff all the time. I don't do it for the rebound effect. I just know that that's creates good energy around me. And who couldn't use that?
Well, it's a beautiful story. And I commend you for taking action. And I also commend you for noticing those who didn't. And I think it speaks volumes of where we're at. And when you talk about consciousness and you start bringing consciousness into the conversation, what you start to realize very quickly is that there are different expressions of consciousness, and everybody's personal makeup and experience and beliefs and karma and everything that exists within the entity of a person plays a role at any given moment. So some people aren't aware that they're even walking by, perhaps, or not even aware that she may need help, or may just think that, well, I don't want to get involved, or COVID, or, there's lots of different things that could be.
Yeah, there was no condemnation there of mine. It was just, I noticed this whole scene like a movie, and I noticed that I was moving forward towards her automatically to help pick up strawberries. And the little kid said, 5-second rule. So you can just wash off the strawberries and eat them. And everybody else just kept milling around for whatever their reasons were. And again, there was no judgment. It was just so interesting.
Yeah.
And when you were talking about this stuff, it just brought that to mind. It's so simple.
It's these ordinary moments of opportunity where we make choices to create karma that pass us by sometimes, or that grab us, and we really get to be present in that. And one of the things I've also learned working with the monks these past 6 months is karma isn't necessarily what the Western perspective thinks of it. The Western perspective is very new age karma. A lot of people will say, good luck with that karma. And karma has become known as something on the more negative side, because it's something you've done that's bad, perhaps, that creates something that will come back to bite you. And so we walk around thinking that that's what karma is, and wishing that kind of situation on people, which they don't even realize is not a very good thing. The power of our thoughts and the power of our mind mixed with our emotional fields really is what creates that fertile juice of artists and being able to get something out onto a canvas or something captured into a photograph. But art in itself isn't the end point. The end point is that we still aren't even what we create. We have some higher perspective, deeper perspective, and yet we can still go about these mundane things like helping somebody who's dropped strawberries or washing our dishes. I know that in the East, Huyang, the tea ceremonies is something that's really sacred. And some people can spend many years studying the tea ceremony, and I've just recently found my way to it. And I love tea, so I was all about it. And I said, okay, I can do this. But what I realized too was that it was one more example of how mindful and present are you really? Are you stuck in fantasy? Are you stuck in delusion? Are you thinking so much about what you're building that you forget where you're standing? And so these different concepts of deeper understanding of things, you know, sometimes people will take a look at these different philosophies and say, well, it's kind of riddle. It's like a riddle. And it's like you're being told that something exists, yet it doesn't exist. And it's always contradicting itself. Can't we just skip to chapter 380 and learn there? And yeah. So the first thing they teach us in Zazen is to follow the breath. And the only thing you're supposed to do is follow the breath. And then after that, then you follow, you know, it's like a screen in your mind. And there's so many similarities between other different traditions of meditation too, that we really could, I think, combine a lot of efforts here to create something quite spectacular for each of us. I wish they taught it in school. Do they teach it in school, Hyung? There, I don't know much about China. I don't know much about anything because they don't let a lot of information out.
Well, also, I guess it's just a extra barrier when all those interesting things that you just mentioned, they originally happened in Chinese. And we have a very abstract understanding about a lot of things. It's almost like if you achieve optimal state, then it's often just something that it's not tangible. It's really hard to translate, I feel. And also with just the way you spoke about Confucianism, Buddhism, and the tea ceremony and all that, I just find that to be so, so interesting because it is used in a slightly different way as it transcends borders, cultures, and time. So I think for the traditional Chinese way of looking at it, it's often through very slow motion do we understand these things, or are these things manifested? And there's so much patience that's given to it because it's almost assumed that if you do anything quickly, it's not going to succeed. And you have to sort of endure. It's almost like looking at water sort of slowly erode rocks and stone. Can you get the essence of life and also the philosophy of a lot of the things that Hillary just mentioned? So I just find that to be so interesting because it, through that process, we are supposed to be able to reach calmness and some kind of peace and make peace with ourselves. And that's a really integral part of the whole process. But also, when you look at today in the modern times, it's almost like those ancient practices and culture is kind of contradictory with the fast pace of life, and we're always trying to sort of increase our efficiency and, like you said, get to the end chapter or whatever it is. You know, we don't have the patience to sort of really digest, reflect, and wait. And Chinese people feel that very much. And that's why I think today, a lot of the Confucius teachings, ideas, it's simmered to various aspects in life, but it's also really hard to, I think, for people to sort of really touch it. Like, there's Confucius ideas and teachings that one can argue that reflects in politics, the way the government is set up in this country, also in the way that people, everyday people, conduct our daily lives and how we treat each other and also how we look at the family construct, for example, in this country. A lot of it goes back to these ancient philosophies. But like, how can that be useful for today's minds and people? I think it's just fascinating. And just seeing that how you find the little bits and pieces that you find to be, you know, nurturing or good for you. I think that's great. Maybe the purpose of these ancient philosophies is that we can find the nutrients that we need today and just take the bits that we find useful. And maybe that's it.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, how do we bridge the old ancient teachings to the modern day uses? I don't believe that these people who were teaching philosophy in 500 BC ever expected 2020 to be what it is, or us to be so engulfed in the digital realms. And it brings an entirely new conversation to the table, which is, and we talk about this in our group meetings a lot, we talk about how the digital world really is a world, and it really is something that you click into or attach to and kind of get on and ride. It's a signal of sort of vibration. So how do we take these ancient old philosophies and associate them to our modern day complexities? And if we think about it long enough, I'm sure we'll come up with some kind of example of how we can do this, because at the end of the day, Confucius was just one philosopher of many who, through time, brought to the table some sort of way to organize social structure. I mean, really, this had to do with social structure. You can't study ancient philosophy and not connect it to the social structures at the time. So they were political. They were going into social structures and talking about certain things and how to relate it. And I think some of the stories that they used, they were very, very good at using story to bring up these interesting teachings and to give them to people who didn't formally follow any tradition necessarily, or were curious, or just learning. The beginner's mind is something to really consider. I mean, when you have a beginner's mind, you're open to learning. Whereas if you have an expert mind, you know what your expertise is, you know what your speciality is. However, can you let go of that knowledge to go back to a beginner's mind and say, well, let me think about this? And science really needs to remember to go back to the beginner's mind. I think that's one thing we need to teach the generations growing up, no matter where we're from. But using it in a modern context really has to do with being able to, I guess, wrap your mind and your energy around the moment, the present moment. If I had to really explain it to somebody who had no reference or didn't understand any of it, like I did when I signed up for my class, I really didn't have any idea what I was signing up for. But at the end of it, I realized all the synchronicities, all the signs, all of the happenings, everything that I have gone through up until this point in my life had led me here. And something bigger than myself wasn't going to let me walk away from it. So I said, fine. And I think our modern context is changing even just in the last 6 months, of what it means to be aware of other people's health, or aware of our own health, or aware of how we socially distance but yet still maintain strong connection, because we can't lose connection because we're a connective species. And all of these ancient philosophies talk about the connectedness of humans and how they interrelate and what they are used for. In fact, reaching enlightenment has a lot to do with the fact that you can reach enlightenment in a conversation with somebody you don't even know. You can reach enlightenment with mundane things. So I commend you in sharing that. And I'm curious, Huyang, what it's like for you to be a young woman in a Chinese culture raising children, and what that means, because I think this whole bridge idea really has to do with waking up what it is for each of us, wherever we're at, and how that is, and learning from each other so that we can understand each other better. Because without understanding each other, there really isn't a bridge. Because a bridge isn't a destination, it's a tool to cross from one place to another. So how is it, how, this is my radio personality coming out. I can't help it, John. I'm going to ask a question.
Here's what I knew was going to happen. I was going to introduce you Then I'm going to turn my microphone off for 38 minutes and let you two talk, and then I'll come back and say thank you. But yes, she has many. Hillary's done some great work in radio here in the States and online and virtually and all that kind of stuff. So she's well known all over the world. So I will let her, but she's well aware of the time because I've actually sent her a couple of messages.
Oh.
That's okay. But Hugh Young, you guys go ahead and finish that up, and then, of course, we'll thank you.
Okay. So I'm really curious what it's like for you to be a mom in a culture that our Western perspective is that China is very controlling, doesn't allow their population to have a lot of freedom when it comes to thought and expression. And so there's this weird perspective here in the States that the Chinese culture is very contained and controlled by their government, and that shapes everything that you do over there. And I'm just wondering if that's true.
Well, actually, that is a really good question. And I think the people here might feel quite differently about that. Because, like, if you look at the way people conduct their lives and also express themselves through the private sphere, it's very, very vibrant. It's very, very vibrant in the sense that you see the art scene being very popular, and art has become something that has actually reached the homes of so many people, which it's no longer sort of a luxury for, you know, the privileged few. And also you see a really interesting and developing culture that's expressed by young people as well, and there's graffiti art in China as well. So I think there's definitely, I think, maybe a misunderstanding, or I think people need to know more about what other people's lives are in a different country such as China. And I would encourage people to come over to have a look, kind of thing. Of course, that would be after COVID-19 is controlled and all that. And we don't know when that's going to be.
Yes.
And yeah, so a lot of these things, it has to be seen to believe, kind of thing. Cause, me just saying it would still be, you know,
right,
expressing through my sort of, perspective.
Right.
But I would say that it's very different from what you would imagine, and very different from what is portrayed in Western media. So there is definitely a lot of freedom to express, but there are certain boundaries, I suppose, that are there. So it's an interesting subject for sure.
Well, the fact that we're doing this show, right? So there's nobody looking over my shoulder tonight in Chicago. There's nobody looking over your shoulder in Beijing. And I know that through the conversations we've had that that these programs and the things that you work on, you have the same freedom, because she's also the host of the China Roundtable, that, you know, as a journalist, not just a citizen of Beijing, but also as a journalist, you know, you have to have the kind of access to the media that makes your work important and that you're able to put yourself out there. So one of the side effects, I think, of the bridge, Hillary, is that having these conversations and asking a direct question like that and getting a direct answer helps build another piece of the bridge out. Whereas if that wasn't asked, it's a wall. And there's a huge difference in both those structures. And there isn't any... I've said this before on a couple of the shows. You know, I'm born and raised here. I love living in America. But I've traveled the world and I've seen places I'd like to live and places that I probably wouldn't want to live. And every time I come back, I feel a sense of home. And I'm learning that that's a common theme with everybody, no matter where you're at. So underneath the headlines that say X, Y, and Z, what the show's about, what this conversation's been about, what we're about, is having those conversations. So those headlines melt away and the lifelines become more prominent. Probably not going to happen in my lifetime, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway. And I can't think of a better way to spend whatever this part of my career is, and having conversations that really matter and not majoring in minor things, whatever people define that as. So, you know, that's kind of my piece of this. And listen, Hillary, I got to tell you, I was waiting for the radio person to come out. It was building, and it was building, and it was building, and then it came out. And let me ask you a question. So it's great stuff. And, you know, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. We've known each other a long time. I learned things about you tonight that I really didn't know. Your artwork is fantastic.
And I appreciate this opportunity. And Hooyoung, I wish I could ask you 20 more questions because I was really dying through the whole time as I was talking about myself. I really wanted to talk about you. And I wanted to hear more about what it's like because I think that's so necessary. And until we do, we just get stuck in our delusions and you know, judgments and perceptions that aren't necessarily true.
Well, let's do that off the show or maybe on a different show. Sure. And I would love to communicate more with you, Hillary. Absolutely fascinating what you had to share. And also, I can't wait to check out your artwork as well.
Thank you so much. And thank you, John. I've grown through the years with you by my side in some ways. And I appreciate you and all that you have done for the world as well.